we're going to continue diving into gross receipts tax style and value added tax style tax methodology. And tonight we're going to get probably further in the in this than we have so far with the legislative revenue officer, Chris Allendak. And the co-chair and I have asked him to take a gross receipts tax example rate and apply it to some different companies, do the same with the value-added tax rate, and do and mix and match and see which kinds of industries or companies fare, do better or worse under each plan. And then we're also going to introduce tax incidence modeling and show you the model of the gross receipts tax example, still working out some bugs on the VAT tax model. So with that, Mr. Allendak, I'll let you get started.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In OLIS, there are three documents. So the first one is entitled Tax and Examples. So we'll walk through that. And as Isaac's pulling that up, this is trying to take a different take on the examples that we've talked about in the past. We get a lot of questions about examples, and they can be helpful, but no one example really tells the entire story. And I try to put them together to highlight certain aspects, and so we'll go through that. The commercial activities tax that I've outlined here, the only exemption under this version is petroleum. And the tax here is calculated as $250 plus 0.40% of sales above $1 million. So up into $1 million, the tax is a flat 250, and then for every dollar above $1 million of an Oregon sales, the tax is 0.48%. The chart for below that, the table below that, are tax year estimates for a CAT of that nature, 0.48. And so in 2020, it raises $1.3 billion. And then I have that growing forward related to the forecast and the personal income. So by 2025, it grows to just under $1.7 billion.
Isaac, we scroll back up to the top row. Yeah.
And so that's really setting the stage for the tax that we're talking about. There have been a lot of different varieties, and there are a lot of parameters to choose from and policy levers. But to put forward some examples, I need to identify a tax, and the examples in this document are related to that tax.
Okay, if I could summarize a little bit. This is a gross receipts tax style at 0.48, and our mandate is to raise somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion a year. This one comes in over that, but this is just for illustrative purposes.
Yes, this is illustrative purposes, and it ties into the OTIM runs later.
Okay.
Rather than trying to keep things fairly fixed within here. The OTIM runs have a couple of other policies, but that's correct. So that's the 1.3 is above that $1 billion.
And
Senator Nicholson.
Thank you. And just to continue along the lines of making sure we're clear about what we're talking about, 0.48 is less than 1%. That's an important thing to know here, less than 0.5%, as Representative Smith Warner says. And this is called on here commercial activities tax. We currently have a corporate income tax, so this is just a different type of corporate tax, right?
Yeah, it's a gross receipt style tax. We've had different names, so I'm trying to stick with a common name going across and not trying to change it every time. But this part is, as Coacher House was saying, a gross receipts tax. So Oregon sales, so the calculation is simply what is your Oregon sales, and then your tax is plugged into that. It's basically 0.48% of your Oregon sales.
Mm-hmm.
And then to bounce to a description of the business activities tax, which is a value-added type of tax. So here, this is a simplification of the OBI BAT proposal. It doesn't get into all of the all of the pieces of it, but it is meant to convey the conceptual sense of that plan. And so here, the value added is calculated at the U.S. level. So you take a company operating in however many states and you look at their federal situation. So you take their gross receipts, you subtract their inventory costs. This is what, at one point, I was referring to as cost of goods sold. It has been referred to purchases from other businesses. These are basically the inputs going into the business. So if you think of, for example, a manufacturer that produces tables, it might be the wood that they buy to produce the tables. And there are a variety of other costs that are subtracted from this tax, capital investments, for example. I didn't want to put too many moving parts on here, but the main concept is you start with gross receipts tax and then you're subtracting certain items, so you're getting to a smaller tax base. So to raise a given amount of money, you need a larger tax rate. So this value-added calculation is done at the national level. So then for a given company, you have their national value-added. Then the next step is to apportion that value-added to Oregon. And that's similar to the current corporate income tax, where our starting point is federal taxable income, and then the question is, how much of that federal taxable income does Oregon get to tax? And we currently use a single sales factor, which is borrowed and included here, where the apportionment is the Oregon receipts divided by U.S. receipts. So it's similar to that single sales factor notion. And this is the step where the value added gets transformed, if you will, from an origins-based tax, to a destination-based. You're taking the U.S. value added, and only the percentage of Oregon sales gets becomes the Oregon tax base. So then the tax is that U.S. value added times that apportionment percentage times a 1.4% tax rate. And the 1.4% was chosen to arrive at the estimates at the table at the bottom there for the tax year going from 2020 to 2025. And the BAT here is about $1.3 billion. I just wanted to line it up with the CAT.
Okay.
That's how that was chosen. The BAT base here is about $96 billion.
And under both of these, the current corporate income tax remains the same.
Correct. What I've described here are just the new taxes. There are no other changes at this point.
Okay.
And then the examples, if we're ready to turn to the examples, the intent here is to walk through four kinds of businesses and simply comparing the CAT liability for a given business to the BAT liability. So to walk through those one at a time, the first one is a manufacturer. And their U.S. sales are $600 million, and their Oregon sales are $15 million. Keep in mind that these are all figures that I've just plugged in to try and really get at examples of comparing these two bases. And the inputs for the manufacturer, $375 million. So that's the material, that's the inputs to their manufacturing process. They also have capital investments of $50 million and other expenses of $5 million. So their BAT base is $170 million. That's the $600 million less the $375, $50, and $5. So their BAT base is $170 million. So right here, we can see that the gross receipts tax base is the $15 million from Oregon sales, and the BAT base is $170 million. That $170 million is the U.S. figure. And their apportionment percentage is 2.5%. And the 2.5% is simply the $15 million divided by the $600 million. And of course, now I realize I should have included another line there that actually multiplied those two out.
Mm-hmm.
So my apologies for excluding that. So for this company, the manufacturer, the CAT is $67,200, and that's just the formula from above multiplied by the $15 million. And the BAT, the $59,325, is the 1.4% times the Oregon base. And so it is a byproduct of how I've structured the numbers that the bat in this case would be less than the cat. And part of where I was going here was under the notion of comparing these two, the gross receipts tax is set at, that's the base, you don't subtract anything from it. And for this manufacturer, they have a fairly sizable amount of input costs, so their tax base is smaller. And then that's reflected in their BAT tax being less than the CAT tax. The second column there is a consultant, and what I was really going for here was some sort of service company. It could be a medical office, it could be an attorney's office, the idea being a service provider. So their U.S. sales are $30 million, and their Oregon sales are $5 million. So again, we have an interstate company, multi-state company. Their input costs are $6 million, and they happen to have capital investments of $1 million and then other expenses of $500,000. So their U.S. BAT base is $22.5 million. And their apportionment percentage is the 5 divided by 30, so that's 16.7%. And for this company, their CAT tax liability, their business tax for CAT, is just over, it's $19,200, and that's roughly the 0.48% times actually $4 million, because the first $1 million is not part of the base. It's the 0.48 for Oregon sales above. So for this company, it's $250 plus 0.48% of $4 million, because their Oregon sales are $5 million. And their BAT base is the 22.5 million times the 16.7% times the 1.4%. And so their tax is $51,333. The third example is an Oregon-only restaurant. So their U.S. sales and Oregon sales are identical at $6 million. And their input costs are $3.2 million. Capital investment of $500,000 and other expenses of $200,000. So using the same arithmetic as before, their BAT base at the U.S. level, which in this case is identical to Oregon because it's an Oregon-only company, is $2.1 million. And that's the $6 million minus 3.2 minus 0.5 minus 0.2. Their apportionment percentage is 100% because it's an Oregon-only company. And here, the CAT is $24,000 and the BAT is $22,400. And I would note, I've set up the mix going either way because the math there really is a product of the inputs at the top part. Then the last example is an agricultural producer where U.S. sales are $150 million and Oregon sales are $16 million. Their inputs are $60 million, and then they have capital investments of $30 million and other expenses of $11 million. So their BAT base is $49 million, and their apportionment percentage, 16 divided by 150, is 10.7%. And in this case, their tax is pretty similar under the CAT or the BAT, just around $72,000. But the key takeaway I'm trying to convey here with one tax being higher or lower than the other, depending on the example, is in the real world, it depends on a company's not structure per se, but it's really the input cost where you're comparing the gross receipts, because the gross receipts tax is simply the Oregon sales multiplied by the rate, where under the BAT, you're starting with gross receipts, and then you're subtracting things from that. The biggest one is usually the input costs. So where that's going to be a difference is if you're the kind of company that has a lot of input costs, you know, manufacturing, retail, wholesale, then your bases will be very different between a gross receipts base and a BAT base. So on the other hand, if you're more of a service company where you don't buy a lot of inputs, then you're not subtracting a lot from that base and from gross receipts. And so the gross receipts and the BAT base are going to be a little more similar.
Chris, on the that, some of the people that like this method assume it will replace the current corporate income tax. So how much is the current corporate income tax raise? And if you did replace it, what would the rate have to be to hit those same target levels?
The current corporate income tax brings in, I believe, from the last forecast, about $700 million a year. That's what's projected over the next 5 or 6 years. So with a BAT base working here, I said 96 million, I'm gonna round that to 100 million. To raise that $700 million to replace the elimination of the corporate income tax, the BAT would need to raise another $700 million. So in building on the math here, that rate would have to go from 1.4% to 2.1%, another 0.7% to make up for that piece. And that is one of the decisions, it's a notable decision whether we're talking about just adding a new tax or to what extent are other taxes reduced or offset.
Mm-hmm. And I think we have, I don't know, agreed to is the word or phrase, but we have talked that a personal income tax reduction is necessary. One of these versions.
No.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you. I was trying very hard to do the math, not to check on you, but just to remind myself that I know how to do it. And I wasn't getting the right numbers, but then I did. So I don't know what I was doing wrong at first, but it all ended up flowing.
And of course, I apologize to the committee. As I was walking through this, I'm already thinking of six things I'd do differently to present the information a little more clearly.
Because on each of them, to get to the CAT, you take the Oregon sales minus a million for the assumption of you exempt the first million, and then you multiply that by 0.48%.
Right, which is 0.0048, depending on how people like to work their calculators.
Depending on your calculator, exactly.
So. And then add $250.
Oh, I missed that one. Good. And then could I ask, I know that LRO, under some significant privacy restrictions, is able to use some actual information in computing things for us in a way that protects the privacy. Is there a way you could do some examples without telling us who it was, that you could use a couple examples of actual businesses? Or is this some version of that?
That would be a felony. So.
Okay.
Not to put too fine of a point on it.
All right, so maybe we could have Senator Haas do it then?
Sure. I'll drive the getaway car.
All right. No, because you have legislative immunity during session, so you'd be fine.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to be flippant. We do have access to the information, and without going into all of the interactions between the two being LRO and the Department of Revenue, it takes more time, but we can certainly delve into real life examples, but we do have to blur the information in such a way. And now we start going down a path where the whole point of that information is so that a company can't be identified. Now, if you pick a company at random out of the tax returns, you're unlikely to do that. But DOR wouldn't let us do that, and I don't know that we'd want to go down that path. But that's a good point. The examples that we're putting together here, I'm not trying to be completely fictional. We want to be.
That's what I was just going to say.
I assume that you use some knowledge you have about how, about the kinds of businesses that we have, and that these are examples of the kind, even though it's not the exact numbers, I just want to give you credit on the range, a manufacturer, and with so many different inputs. So I'm assuming that you use some of your knowledge about that going into it. So I was just curious how kind of close to reality it is or could be.
For example, to that point, I will take sectoral averages And so I'll go for the manufacturing sector, so we'll have those C corporations. They might be broken down by Oregon only or multi-state, but I'll have that sector information, and then I can calculate an average from that and use something along those lines. Usually the response I get from CPAs or business folks who know this very familiar is they would love to have the profit margins that come out of these examples. So to that extent, they're not necessarily accurate along those lines. Again, the intent here is to show how the levers between the cat and the bat compare in certain sense. So on the one hand, these can be expanded, you know, like I was saying, the consultant is, you know, can be a doctor's office or something along those lines. It can be expanded to other sectors. On the other hand, any private company who knows exactly these calculations and has access to their own information can make their own exact calculation, and it would be likely to be very different from these.
Thank you.
All right, so these are the two examples only for illustration purposes. And what we're gonna go to next, but before we go to that, this is the static results of illustrations. In other words, just the mathematics of here's how many businesses, here's how much in sales, multiplied by a rate, and here's your revenue. The modeling, Chris, if you could give us a word on why we do it, what it shows, and the significance of being able to show these kinds of illustrations.
Sure. So before we jump into that, before we pull that up on the screen, these are from our OTIM model, which we've had for 18 or 19 years.
OTIM.
And OTIM stands for Oregon Tax Incidence Model. Technically speaking, it is a comparative statics model, and it is meant to take tax policy, and we feed it static estimates. So there's kind of a two-step process. So for tonight, we took the CAD estimate, and that was the static estimate for a given year. We input it into the model, and what this model is of Oregon's economy, and there are a lot of detailed calculations for the tax sector. It was designed with the tax sector in mind. As the name would suggest, it's a tax incidence model. And there are a lot of, it's a general equilibrium model where there are a lot of equations around factor markets, labor supply, labor demand, prices, wages, cost of capital. And all of this model was built back in about 2000 or 2001 through a series of work groups and experts to weigh in on how the model was constructed. And the idea is to provide some insight and provide one tool for the legislature to think about the impact of tax policy. So it's really trying to go from the very micro of these examples, these four sample companies, to provide some kind of insight as to what the economic landscape would look like if the law were changed. So we have a lot of different parameters that we look at, and basically trying to describe how all stakeholders in the economy and how the economy would respond to the change. So the model is, as I said, it's a comparative static. So we assume the Oregon economy is in equilibrium, and then we shock the system is kind of the lingo that the modelers use. And we change the tax structure, and then we run the model so that all of the equations solve again, and so it returns back to equilibrium. And so that's the comparative statics. We're comparing two points in time. It's not what we would call a cyclical model. It's very different from the state economist, for example, who does a trend model or a cyclical model projecting tax revenue and personal income for every year over the next 10 years. This is just two points in time. And our base assumption there, and has been since the beginning, is that the time period between the two equilibria is about 5 years. So it takes time for everybody to respond. These models, these regional models, rely heavily on some migration assumptions as people might respond to levels of taxation. That's what the model really does. We're going to change the income tax, we'll create a new tax, then how do businesses respond, how do households respond?
Okay.
So the first one we have here, there are two versions. The first one is Revenue Package SIM 1. And so this is the one that creates a commercial activities, the commercial activities tax, just like in the examples we went through. But it also includes a change in the personal income tax rates. The current rates are 5, 7, 9, and 9.9. This simulation has those rates being reduced to 4.5, 6.5, and 8.75. And that's why, while the target is $1 billion, those initial estimates were a little bit above. They're about 1.3 billion. The rough estimate for the reduction in these tax rates is about $300 million. So that's how those fit together. So, so the output we have is some standard output that we've developed over the years, and we've been using this for several years now. In the top box here, we have certain key criteria or metrics that people have are interested in. As we've talked with stakeholders over the years, and Paul had these conversations a lot, different people like to focus on different aspects. And so the ones that are here are some of those key ones. So just marching through those, you have the personal income is about $200 billion. It's $225 billion. This is one way we measure the size of the economy. And this is a metric that the state economist forecasts in his forecast. It's one way to measure the size of the economy. And right here, the starting point is $225 billion. And while I mentioned that the time frame here we've assumed to be 5 years, we've collapsed it all into 1 year for comparison purposes. Over this 5 year time arc, all of these changes would happen very incrementally, but to show how the changes between one equilibrium and the next, we've collapsed them into 1 year. And so what we see with the personal income, with the new tax of about $1 billion net, it's really not changed much. The size of the economy as measured by personal income is less by about 0.06%. So it's a little bit on the negative side. And as I talk through this, hopefully that'll become clear the factors that lead to that. And the next thing we look at is nominal per capita personal income. And that actually increased just a hair, but just by 0.07. So both of these changes are pretty close to no change.
Why a negative on, or why the increase? So the average person will have a few more pennies in his pocket.
Correct.
Okay. As a result of this new business tax and the personal tax cut over time.
Right. And all of the responses that are built into the model. And that's where we get to the migration. These are regional models. And people respond to taxes. And what we see here is the employment and the population both go down. And so the population goes down by about 6,000 and employment falls by about just over 8,000.
And that's a result of it's a less desirable place to be, taxes are too high, or just whatever.
Yeah, we've gone to a consumption tax. And so there are offsetting factors here. The reduction in the PIT rates would make the state a little more desirable because the income taxes are less, but the consumption taxes now exist. So it's the interaction of the two, which is really the intent of the model, is to provide some insight as to how those responses would play out. And so what we're seeing here is the population is going down, and you'll even see that the nominal wage there goes up by about 0.2%. And so what we've seen from a number of runs that we've done over the years is the change in the mix of the people. So, for example, a retail sales tax that's not what's being considered here, is pretty regressive. So it affects people at different levels of income differently. And so the response that we're getting here seems to indicate that with the commercial activities tax at this level of $1 billion, is suggesting that Oregon's a little bit less desirable, so there's less migration into the state. This is not saying, I would argue, that people are leaving the state per se. that it's ending jobs or causing people to flee the state. Keep in mind, it's over this time period, and it's all about the migration. So the projection of where we would be in 5 years is a little bit less than it would be otherwise. So it's the migration would be a little bit less. The other piece to point out there is net investment is on the minus side, but it's again pretty close to zero. So this, the size of the economy is a little bit less, and there are fewer people, and employment is down a little bit. The wage index has gone up. Some of that could be due to the migration effect of the income tax going down and higher income tax and higher income folks being more sensitive to that tax and less sensitive to a consumption tax. And that's embedded in the nature of consumption taxes being regressive. We also have price levels going up by 0.4, and that's basically the passing on of the tax to the consumption side. And so those are some of the key metrics that we look at.
Okay.
Keep bouncing down to the box below here, and maybe I should change the order of these, but we have the static revenue impact of $1.1 billion. That's the combination of the two policies. So it's a little more than the target. The dynamic revenue impact is pretty minimal. It's $27 million.
So can you explain what that is?
And the dynamic impact is it gets a little bit muddy when you have an increase and a decrease in the same policy. It's a little cleaner to think about just a tax increase or a tax decrease. And if you have a tax increase, the only policy is a tax increase, and say it's going to raise $1 billion, then we would expect as that tax increase works its way through the economy and households and businesses respond to it, it actually doesn't raise quite that amount. So the dynamic feedback effect would be negative. Another, the reverse side of that is on tax cuts. So a tax cut, we could see, let's say it's a tax cut of $100 million, then as people respond to that, the lower prices that would filter through the economy, the actual impact would not be the minus $100 million. It might be minus $90 million.
I see.
And generally what we found over the years is this dynamic feedback effect has been between 5 and 10%. So it does show that there is a response. It just, we haven't found anything that really is overly responsive, if that's the right phrase. And if we think about the size of tax changes to the economy, we're talking about Oregon having a $200 billion economy, and even raising taxes at $1 billion, that's still a small percent of the economy. Not that, I don't mean to say $1 billion is a small amount of money, but in terms of the size of the economy, percentage-wise. So then the last thing we look at here is a tax incidence piece. And when this model was put together and the work groups were looking at it back in the early 2000s, there was a lot of interest in not only having this high-level modeling output that we just talked about briefly, but also the tax incidence. How does it affect, how do certain tax changes affect different levels of income? And so OTIM is a very high-level model. There are 9 households in here at those income levels, where the lowest income group is up to $20,587. And then the top income group is those with incomes above about $206,000.
So when you look at this, when you combine the consumption effects of the gross receipts tax, even with the personal tax cut, every household category will see a negative result over 5-year time. I don't know, but they're all in the red there.
Right, they're all in the red, and that this is what we generally see from the OTIM output as the money, it's the tax going from the households, from the private sector to the public sector. One thing here that we're seeing with the commercial, with gross receipts type taxes, is it's fairly proportional, where for every household, the reduction in income is about 0.3%. Mm-hmm. And keep in mind that the number of households vary across the groups. There was discussion about doing quintiles versus groups like this, and the general consensus was that this is a little more intuitive for people to understand. When you start talking about quintiles, it can be a little more confusing. There's an argument for presenting the information that way, but this seemed to be more intuitive.
Thank you. Quintiles, not that kind of a word that rules out in conversation of. All right, so this is what you would call the 5-year forecast. And so let's look at your longer term modeling.
Okay. So the other simulation is revenue package SIM1L. And this kind of approach is something we started doing about 8 or 10 years ago, 7 or 8 years ago. And the question that we often got, or one of the criticisms of OTIM, is on the spending side. That side, when it was developed, we have a lot of pieces on taxes and a lot of different kinds of taxes. That's how it was built. But the spending side is not as developed. We have 4 sectors. We have state and local, and then education and non-education. And so to address some of that criticism, we looked into how we might be able to do that. And there is a, what I'll call a productivity factor in the model that we can set. There isn't a whole lot of academic direction on what that level should be. But again, this is supposed to be illustrative of potential spending effects. And the whole idea here is that spending matters. How the state spends the money matters in terms of what kind of impact it would have on the economy. So everything is the same here, except for this productivity factor is turned on, if you will. And the argument here is that this money is being raised and will be dedicated to education spending. So all of the money would go to, well, at this point, it's just education. I mean, there can be, you know, teachers or how that gets spent, but this is all going to education. And the argument there is, assuming that it is spent well and spent efficiently on education, that over time, over a longer time period, the state would have a more productive labor force. And so this is a longer time horizon, and that's what the L stands for. It's a long-term piece.
Long-term meaning 10 years?
As a rule of thumb, we're kind of using the 10. It's not solid in terms of what that would be, but given the original, the base model is a 5-year time horizon, this goes to a 10-year. That's kind of what we've used over the years. It is very loose.
Right,
but that's one way to conceptualize it. And here, the big change is a lot of the negatives that showed up that were in that first simulation, many of them turn positive. The personal income increases by 0.66%, basically going from about $225 billion to $226 billion. The nominal personal income increases a little bit. The employment and the population are still down, but population is almost flat. And in fact, the change from the baseline in terms of number of people rounds to zero. So no change in the number of population. The number of employed is still down a little bit by about $3,000. But investment turns positive. It increases by about 0.5%. And the wage index increases by 1%. And this is reflective of the assumption of the money being spent efficiently and a more productive labor force. So if you go down to the static and dynamic revenue impact here, the static impact stays the same. That's the input into the model. The dynamic impact goes from a slight negative to about $200 million positive.
Why is that?
Again, gets back to the assumption that on how the money is spent, and you have a more productive labor force, and so incomes are increasing. And then you can even see that in the tax incidence piece around the difference in the income. Most of those turn from negative to positive. You still have the lower income folks where those bottom couple of households are still on the negative side. And part of that, there is, I guess I don't have, they, well.
A lot of them don't even file taxes, so it's hard to affect them with taxes.
But you do see a positive impact on the higher income folks and benefiting from that. And that's the education leading to a more productive workforce. And again, it's just built on this assumption about this one parameter. And we've run this approach a few times in 2017. If people look back at those simulations, anytime, that's what the L stands for in these simulations. That's how we've labeled these to signal that we've turned this parameter on, if you will.
And the bottom line, I guess the simplified way to say it is there is some benefit to the economy, to people's wages long-term when you dedicate the money to education. But there's, and that used to be the criticism of some of these. Well, you're not looking at what the taxes go to.
Yeah, that was, and it's a legitimate criticism on the spending side. Now, the challenge we have there in from the academic literature is what does different kind of spending do, public sector spending do to the economy? There's still a lot of debate and lack of consensus around what that does. But this is a productivity factor that it's making that assumption.
Very interesting.
So it's meant to be one piece of information to consider as you're moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And we're trying to work out the bugs to do a VAT simulation.
Yes, we are working on that. And I probably shouldn't get too technical.
Yeah, that's good. That's enough.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry, Senator Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Chris, the numbers that we're looking at, this is a true baseline in the sense that the numbers are real from our economy and our taxpayers. These weren't, where did you get the numbers that we're staring at?
The baseline, the model that, the current version of OTIM is built on tax year 2012. Since it was created back in 2000, we have updated it two or three times. And the most recent time was a couple years ago, and there's always a couple years lag for data. So the guts of the model, if you will, the data, are 2012. We take something called in-plan data, is a core piece of it, but then we augment that with actual tax return data from the Department of Revenue. We go over there and we look at the income tax returns, and we have property tax data that we have access to augment the in-plan data. And so it's a 2012 version, and then we grow it to the current year based on the most recent economic forecast from the state economist.
And follow up, Mr. Chair. Yes. So when you add in the education piece and the assumption being that if you invest $2 billion into education, you're going to get a more productive future. That's based on, if the current assertion is that our schools are not doing as well as they could, I don't know what that means. Does it mean that we invest the two and we just get back to even? Or are we starting out with a good foundation to build upon and thus we have that production that your model suggests?
I think it's probably the latter. It's the investment being spent wisely in the education system. So whatever the current baseline is, now this is where OTIM doesn't have a baseline assumption of a school education ranking, if you will. There's nothing to input there about our Oregon's education system is at this level. The argument here in turning this on is that the money is spent in the classroom and the education system is better. But that's also why it's a longer term. And that's where the spending matters, depending on how the money is spent, and that's a key assumption.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Nathanson.
Nothing to add yet. I'm taking this all in. It's interesting. It's interesting to note that. After putting what you described, Mr. Alanak, as a shock to the system. Okay, there's a new thing that happens. What does it do to the economy? Even in the first one that you showed us, many of those numbers were close to zero.
And that's generally been the case. I mean, by this point, we've run hundreds of simulations. And that's where I think the easiest way to conceptualize that is the tax change compared to the size of the economy. So we're now, there are a couple of different ways to measure the economy. The one that's right here is personal income. That's $200 billion and on an annual basis. And in this case, the tax change is $1 billion. Whenever we run plans to increase revenue, they've tended to be between a couple hundred million dollars and $1 billion. So they're still in a relatively small percentage of the overall economy. And people do like to focus on some of these percentages, but usually they're between, you know, give or take a percentage point.
As one of those people that like to focus on one of those percentages, I'm surprised that almost all of these economic metrics improve and go into the positive side, except for in this long-term employment. It still is down, although I know it's a rounding error. It's just, but I'm surprised that the personal income goes up quite a bit from the previous five-year plan, and then employment is still in the negative. Can you explain that one?
That one, that has been a sticking point. I know between all of the runs we did in 2017 and as we're getting into it now, there does seem to be this area where if a gross receipts tax gets above, you know, half of this, then that number keeps turning up negative. When in 2017 we ran a variety of models that the revenue gain wasn't as large as this. Now I am kind of condensing a lot of mixed runs, but some of those would be positive. But since we're looking at these, it's the size, and the best explanation I have, it has to do would be with the migration effect right now, in terms of migration being still a little bit less. Mm-hmm. And they do correspond. On this one, the population is virtually a no change, but we still have a 0.1 decrease in employment. And some of that can also be potentially with an income tax cut. Mm-hmm. What households respond to is their net wages, and that's the label down on the bar chart, the total real disposable household income, is they respond to their after-tax wages. Mm-hmm. So basically a reduction in the income tax is kind of a pay raise. Mm-hmm. And businesses like that because it's a pay raise that they don't have to pay. They can even pay a little bit less, and the workers feel better off because their net take-home pay is the same.
So a tweak in the personal income tax reduction may bump that employment?
It could. We haven't really focused on that aspect, but that's potential.
There's something that I heard in a discussion that I was participating in a week or two ago, that another possible explanation for some of this change is that when people have a little bit more disposable household income, especially in a family with children, as someone may decide to work fewer hours, either not work or work fewer hours because they're kids to take care of, or there's some other activity they want to pursue. They may just feel like there's not as much need for that second paycheck, so that person then drops out of the labor force or reduces hours.
And that's one of the challenges in going from a very personal level decision for a given household. Yeah. And you can have those small changes, and then you extrapolate those to the Oregon economy as a whole, and you have a lot of small changes can show up as, you know, larger changes here.
As a 0.1 or a 0.04 of a percent.
Right, it's still a small percentage, but some of those employment numbers can change a little bit, and the population can change a little bit to that effect. But that's all of those individual choices get rolled up into this macro level output that we see here.
Thank you. But still, even though there's an important value to seeing how one type of tax might compare to another type of tax in its impact on the economy, still, this is not an economic forecast. It's not a forecast like when we are forecasting revenue, like you mentioned much earlier. This is not meant to be used as a forecast. When I think about a forecast over a 5-year period, much less a 10-year period, other states might be changing their tax laws. There might be another major change in a federal tax law. There could be a trade war. There are so many different things that could happen that you could never really factor in. So this particular thing, this kind of a model, is useful for comparing situations one point in time to another point in time. But it's not a forecast saying this is going to happen exactly this way.
Correct. It's not a forecasting model. And regardless of how sophisticated or complicated these models are, they are still, it's fair to say, gross simplifications of the economy. And to the point about it not being a forecast model, so last week when the state economist came in and said tax collections for 2018 are going to be X, or 2019 are going to be Y, eventually we can go back in time and say if that was correct or not. In this case, we can't really do that because it's alternate scenarios, alternate realities of what the tax system would be. So it's not a forecasting tool in that sense.
Yet it's much better than someone's hunch. And it's, I think, mm-hmm. a very useful tool, mm-hmm. Knowing that it's not concrete.
I think the fact that we're still using it is a testament to the value and the interest in it, in terms of providing some information as to what these tax changes would mean. And it was put together. We have a report on our website, and we can go back to all of the groups and the input, and a lot of the parameters in the model were taken from academic literature to try and produce as accurate as possible.
I was surprised there's an advisory committee on OTEM mm-hmm. and PhDs and economists.
Yeah, there are three different levels of work groups to try and get at what would be, and it was built off of a California model that was used at the time.
All right, very interesting, and we'll have more of these as the examples and illustrations keep coming forward. Any other questions, Senator Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have one. The change in the personal income tax rates has a, I'm guessing, a pretty significant impact on the outcome, but I'd like to know how much. The PIT,
I'm sorry.
If we took the PIT out, we didn't adjust those rates. I'm just trying to figure out, I need a sense of how big a difference would it make in those. That'd be very interesting to see.
Okay.
I mean, if someone says, we don't need to do that, then it'd be great to see what it would do to the model.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay, I think that's about it for tonight. We're going to try to get the Department of Revenue to talk to us about how they would administer either of these two versions of taxes on Thursday. And of course, Alanek will be joining us again on Thursday. So that clears us for tonight. Thank you all.